Hello and welcome to the Risk Map Podcast, part of the global conversation on geopolitics and security, produced by Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy. I'm Charles Hecker in London.
And in Singapore, I'm Angela Mancini. Welcome to the podcast.
Angela, this week as part of our global tour of risk and opportunity, we'll be talking about Mali, where our West Africa analyst Vincent Rouget recently took the country's political temperature and sampled some of the local aloco.
And we'll also go to Mexico, where we'll take a sober look at cross-border relations with the United States.
Finally, Angela, we'll turn to South Korea, a country plunged into disarray by the removal of President Park Geun-hye and a significant corporate corruption scandal.
But first, let's visit Mali, where Vincent Rouget spent a week at the beginning of the month. Mali is not an easy place to do business, and it's seen more than its share of political upheaval and terrorist violence over the past few years. But, of course, the country remains an important source of gold and will always be of interest to the extractive sector, among others. Vincent gave Chuck an update on what he found when he was there.
Vincent Rouget, welcome back to the Risk Map podcast. You were on just a couple of weeks ago talking about infrastructure opportunities in Africa, but you've just got back from a trip to Mali. Tell us what you were doing there.
Well, Mali has an interesting history. It's about 4 or 5 years ago, it suffered from a major political and security crisis. You had half of the country in the north occupied by Islamist militants, whereas at the same time in the south, you had a coup d'etat that profoundly disrupted the political stability of the country. The transition then happened, and a key question that I wanted to answer is, you know, 4 years into elections and in the new government, has the country fully recovered from that crisis?
Well, you've sort of stolen my next question, so keep going. Has the country recovered, and what is the current political landscape like there?
Well, there's definitely been a recovery. Mali hasn't seen any crisis in the last 4 years. The economy has bounced back, and generally the political environment is more stable, and it's an easier place than a few years ago for businesses to operate. At the same time, unfortunately, one doesn't really go away from a research trip in Mali with a great sense of optimism about the country. There's still large parts of the north that are completely beyond reach of state authority. But perhaps more importantly also, we see a growing sense of frustration among people that these last few years haven't done much, that the new government of Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, after 4 years in power, hasn't achieved much reforms, hasn't really overseen any progress in the economy, and hasn't really improved governance. But then at the same time, there's not really any opposition that inspires a lot of support as elections approach next year. And so we see people increasingly disengaging from politics or rejecting politics altogether. And that's something that doesn't really bode well for the future of the country.
All right, I'll agree with you. That isn't the most optimistic picture. But if you're going there, that means that there's work to be done. What does Mali offer to investors? We've obviously got clients in the region. What's on the agenda for business in Mali?
Well, Mali is a very important gold producer. It's the second largest in Africa after South Africa. And we still have regular interest from mining companies who are looking to acquire permits in the Western mining belt or to expand their operations where they're already operating. There's also opportunities in the energy sector, in particular with solar power, and the infrastructure sector with a lot of donor-funded projects. And finally, we can also say that the crisis has created its own industry and development, NGOs, dealing with fragility.
Vincent, there was a fairly significant security incident in Mali about a year and a half ago with a terrorist attack on a hotel that was used by a lot of business people. Can you go to Mali and can you be safe? Can you actually get business done on the ground?
Well, as a business, you can definitely go to Bamako. And if anything, the main impediment to your trip will probably be traffic on the rather small avenues of the city. That said, the security forces still report detecting terrorism plots quite frequently, and there is clearly an intent from jihadists to target the city. And so a trip to Bamako must involve some precautions and also must involve a bit of an understanding of who is behind these threats and how do they operate, in particular Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, the main jihadist group in the region. AQIM is largely reluctant to incur Muslim casualties, so you're not really much at risk of an indiscriminate suicide bombing targeting a busy marketplace the threat is really going to be targeted on hotels, on bars, on restaurants, where you have a heavy concentration of Western expatriates, where they'll be able to make a lot of Western casualties without incurring too many Muslim casualties. That means that when you're planning a trip to the region as a foreign business, you must take proper care as to what hotel you select, as to the kinds of venues you go to on evenings when the work is done, for dinner or at bars, because these are the areas that are most likely to be targeted. Some of them have already implemented robust security upgrades, others less so, and so it's really a case of reviewing properly where you go during your trip.
Great, Vincent. Well, we look forward to hearing more about your next research trip. Talk to you again soon. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chuck. Simon Whistler is one of our more senior Mexico watchers, and he feels it's time to take a look at what's really happening between the United States and Mexico, setting aside some of the rhetoric and geopolitical hype. Simon dialed in from our Washington, D.C. office.
Simon, welcome to the podcast. It's probably a good time now to take a step back and talk about the relationship between the United States and Mexico without some of the geopolitical circus that's accompanied it in past weeks. How would you estimate the current state of play with U.S.-Mexico relations if you take away some of the rhetoric from recent months?
So the rhetoric, as you say, has certainly died down, particularly as President Trump and the U.S. has become less directly involved in the relations over the past weeks. And as a result, you've seen at least diplomatic exchanges between defense ministers, finance ministers, foreign ministers, things being conducted in a more diplomatic, courteous manner. But I think the important thing is to go beyond the rhetoric, whether kind of angry or in diplomatic speak, and look at the underlying issues. And the underlying issues remain the same. There are significant differences on immigration policy, significant differences on the construction of the wall between the US and Mexico, significant differences on where they want to take NAFTA, the free trade agreement between themselves and also Canada. So those issues remain obviously on the table, they remain unsolved, and those are going to be the issues driving the relations forward over the next few months.
Well, Simon, so what does that mean specifically for Mexico going forward? I mean, you've just named a series of obstacles. Can anything good come out of this? Are there any silver linings to the current situation?
So in the first instance, there's obviously a lot of uncertainty. The statistic that's been commonly repeated over the past few months, 80% of Mexican exports go to the United States, and that accounts for 25% of Mexico's GDP. So any potential renegotiation of NAFTA in particular has potentially very significant implications for the Mexican economy, and you can't ignore that. So there's a huge amount of uncertainty at the moment about where business, where the economy is headed in Mexico over the next year or two as negotiations over NAFTA are resolved. But I think you can see some silver linings. There are bright spots to look forward to. One of those is that I think this gives Mexico a very or much needed push to recalibrate, retune its economic relations with the rest of the world. It's already one of the most open economies in terms of the number of free trade agreements that it has with the rest of the world. But it probably hasn't paid as much attention to those relations as it has to the US through complacency in many ways. So I think this gives renewed emphasis to Mexico to seek out new partnerships, to seek investment from new countries. And you have to remember that Mexico has undertaken a very significant reform program in the past few years, and that's created a number of opportunities in terms of the upstream and downstream energy sector, telecommunications and the like. And so there are opportunities out there, and I think Mexico will be more aggressive in pursuing new partners, new companies from different parts of the world to help them make the most of those.
Simon, you've mentioned NAFTA a couple of times, and I can't let you get away without giving a bit of a forecast on what you think is going to happen to NAFTA. Are we looking at a massive rewrite, or are we looking at renegotiations around the edges?
That's a very good question. The two sides come from it, and we can't exclude Canada from it completely, but the main issues are obviously between the US and Mexico. But the problem is they come from it from very different perspectives. Mexico would prefer to leave it alone, but if they are to renegotiate it, they want to do it from including not just NAFTA, but also the whole gamut of issues that we talked about at the start in terms of immigration, cross-border security. So they want to recalibrate, if they have to recalibrate, the US-Mexico relationships beyond just in terms of purely trade. Whereas the US is looking at some very specific issues within NAFTA in terms of rules of origin, in terms of dispute resolution mechanisms and the like. And so it's very difficult to predict how you reconcile those two visions. So perhaps sitting on the fence a little bit, but I think it gives it an extra flavor to what the complications of these renegotiations and this relationship is going to look like over the next few months.
Thank you for that, Simon. Just one last question, if I can. So next year, looking a little bit further into the future, is an election year in Mexico. And what kind of role are relations with the United States going to play in the Mexican presidential election?
So this is where it gets interesting. The main candidate who's received the biggest bounce in the Mexican polls as a result of the tensions between the US and Mexico at the moment is a candidate called Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's a populist. He's run twice for the presidency before, lost narrowly on both occasions. But he's the type of guy who will benefit from increased tensions, any further disputes between the two countries. In many ways, you can look at him as Mexico's Trump. He channels the same spirit in terms of talking about trying to drain the swamp or drain Mexico City of its corrupt elite. He channels the same spirit about talking about kind of trying to support losers from globalization. They come from overall business and economics from very different perspectives. But that kind of spirit in terms of the populist spirit is very much alive within AMLO, as he's called. And if you add into that an already very unpopular current government in Mexico, unpopular party system, I think the time is right potentially for an outsider such as AMLO to come in and potentially take victory next year or at least play a very significant role in the campaign.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for that, Simon. I'm sure that we'll be talking about this on several occasions before the elections. Simon Whistler in Washington, D.C., thank you very much. South Korean President Park Geun-hye has been ousted from office. While that brings one phase of the country's leadership crisis to an end, it marks the beginning of a critical transition. And Park's fate, now that she's a private citizen, of course, remains to be resolved. This transition comes against the backdrop of a corruption scandal involving the heir to the Samsung conglomerate. Will South Korea's institutions take it through this test? Angela talked to Julia Coyme in our Shanghai office.
Park became the first democratically elected South Korean president to be impeached. The ruling removes Park from office and will revoke her immunity to prosecution. A special prosecutor's investigation has accused Park of several violations relating to corruption and abuse of power, so she'll likely be subject to criminal charges linked to the influence peddling scandal. For South Korea, this ruling triggers early presidential elections. They were originally scheduled for December this year, but must now be held within 60 days. The most likely election date is around 9 of May, but earlier is also possible.
Okay, so we'll definitely see early elections. Who's best placed to win them?
A center-left opposition candidate is most likely to win. The opposition saw a surge in popularity since the scandal kicked off late last year, and former opposition leader Moon Jae-in from the Democratic Party is the candidate to beat among the likely candidates, as he's been leading the polls for 10 weeks straight without even having formally declared his candidacy. So the momentum is very much on the side of the opposition.
And so what would an opposition win actually then mean for the South Korean business community?
An opposition win could lead to a number of fairly significant policy changes, including on competition, chaebol reform, as well as labor reforms. The opposition candidates in recent weeks have called for restructuring of chaebol, which are South Korean conglomerates, to improve the business and competition environment for smaller companies. They've also been very vocal about raising job security for temporary and part-time workers. This would be quite a significant reversal from the reforms the Park administration championed but failed to pass that would have loosened hiring and firing practices for corporations. The reforms proposed by the opposition are instead likely to raise labor costs for businesses.
And what about foreign policy, particularly with regard to North Korea?
The likely presidential candidates from center-left parties have advocated a much less hardline approach to North Korea. Moon Jae-in has said he wants to return to a more engagement-focused policy. He doesn't believe that sanctions are working, and he wants to return to negotiations and offer incentives such as reopening the joint North and South Korean Kaesong Industrial Complex, which was closed by the government after the North's nuclear and long-range missile tests in early 2016. it's not clear that the election of an opposition presidential candidate would lead to an immediate and complete loosening of policy towards North Korea, but it would at least dampen the concerted push to apply pressure.
Very interesting. Thank you very much, Julia. We'll just have to see how things play out in the coming weeks ahead.
Before we sign off, here are a few other issues we're watching closely in the coming weeks. Dutch voters go to the polls on the 15th of March. The entire world, or at least all of Europe, is watching to see if far-right populist candidate Geert Wilders comes out on top, and more crucially, if he does, whether he can form a government. The outcome of this election will send shockwaves one way or the other throughout Europe. Here in the UK, Prime Minister Theresa May is widely tipped to trigger Article 50 in the next couple of weeks. That's when the Brexit Fund should start in earnest.
And EU and International Monetary Fund negotiators said that they will continue talks with Greece in a bid to broker a deal on reforms that Athens must undertake in order to unlock the next stages of its international bailout program. That's it for the Risk Map podcast for the first half of March 2017. Find us every 2 weeks on Podbean, the Control Risk website, and iTunes. This is Angela Mancini in Singapore. Thanks for listening.
Angela, thanks for co-hosting and thanks for the chat. We'll be back in front of the microphones in another couple of weeks, but until then, thanks for clicking, and bye for now from London.